From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we commemorate the 75th anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King. We'll talk with Claiborne Carson, director of the King Papers Project. He'll play an excerpt of a radio interview with King, recorded after he was released from jail in 1960. We'll also talk about King with Shirley Barnhart. She used to think of him as an older brother. She's a lifelong member of the Ebenezer Baptist Church, where King served as co-pastor with his father. Now Barnhart works for the church, describing its history to visitors. And we'll listen back to an excerpt of a 1985 interview with the late James Farmer, co-founder of CORE, one of the first civil rights groups to apply Gandhi's principles of nonviolent resistance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iowa Democrats report to their caucuses shortly as part of their effort to pick the Democratic nominee for president. Dean Borg reports from member station WSUI.
Campaign workers are feverishly encouraging their supporters to ignore the near-zero winter weather. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, who endorsed Howard Dean, says Iowa's prominence in the process could be at stake.
We have a real privilege in Iowa. We are the first in the nation, and I'd like to keep that, both for Republican Party and Democratic Party. That's why it's important for Republicans to go out, too, even though, obviously, they're going to renominate George Bush for their nominee. But it's important to keep the process and to keep Iowa first in the nation.
Iowa Democrats are getting the attention, but Republicans caucus tonight, too. Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani addresses a Republican caucus in Cedar Rapids. For NPR News, I'm Dean Borg in Iowa City.
Tens of thousands of Shiite Muslims marched peacefully through Baghdad today. They were calling for direct elections, as a prominent Shiite leader has demanded. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
Men carrying pictures of Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani marched through the streets of Baghdad, chanting their support for elections, unity, and Iraq's Shiite leaders. Sistani believes elections would be the only fair way to create a transitional parliament for Iraq. The U.S. has been planning a series of provincial caucuses and is facing a tight deadline of July 1st to have a new government in place. The demonstrations happened just hours before representatives from Iraq's interim governing council and U.S. Administrator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, met with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan in New York to discuss the transitional plan. The men marching in the streets of Baghdad say they'll follow Sistani's lead in supporting or denouncing any changes. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
The U.S. has asked the U.N. to help determine whether it's possible to meet al-Sistani's demand for elections in the short time remaining before the U.S. is scheduled to hand over power to a provisional government. Secretary General Annan hasn't said yet whether the U.N. will send a team of experts to Iraq, but he stressed the importance of making a successful transition.
We all agree that it will be easier after 1st of July when a provisional Iraqi government is established. But if we get it wrong at this stage, it will be even more difficult, and we may not even get to the next stage.
U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer and some Iraqi officials have said there isn't time to organize full-scale national elections between now and the 1st of July, when the transition is scheduled to take place. They cite the ongoing violence in the country and the lack of accurate voter rolls. Al-Sistani says the only fair way to choose the new government is by election, a method that would favor the Shiite majority. This is NPR News. The World Health Organization has confirmed that 5 people have died from an outbreak of bird flu in Vietnam. NPR's John Hamilton reports that the outbreak involves an influenza strain that has killed people before.
Most influenzas that infect birds don't pose a threat to people. But this strain, called H5N1, has a history of jumping from birds to people and causing fatal infections. The worst outbreak before this one occurred in Hong Kong in 1997, when H5N1 swept through poultry flocks. 18 people became ill and 6 died. The strain showed up in Hong Kong again last year. 2 people became ill and 1 died. H5N1 is often carried by wild ducks, which transmit it to domestic chickens and turkeys. People can get sick if they handle live birds. So far, there is no evidence that infected people can make other humans sick. Health officials have stopped previous avian flu outbreaks by quarantining flocks and killing literally millions of birds. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Hezbollah guerrillas rocketed an Israeli bulldozer today along the Lebanese-Israeli border, killing one Israeli soldier and wounding at least one other. The guerrilla group claimed the bulldozer had crossed into Lebanese territory, but Israeli army sources denied that. The Israeli army says the bulldozer was in Israeli territory, clearing explosives that had previously been planted by Hezbollah. The Israeli general in the area charged that Lebanon has failed to keep guerrillas from operating in the area as required by a United Nations resolution. Earlier in the day, Lebanese officials accused Israel of violating its airspace by flying warplanes over the Lebanese city of Sidon and Tyre. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features a variety of radios, games, and gadgets selected especially for public radio listeners at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Around the country today, Americans are commemorating the 75th anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. My guest, Claiborne Carson, is the founding director of the King Papers Project, a long-term project to edit and publish the papers of Martin Luther King. Under Carson's direction, 4 volumes have been published of a projected 14-volume edition of King's speeches, sermons, correspondences, publications, and unpublished writings. The project is based at Stanford University, where Carson is a history professor. He was invited to direct the project by Coretta Scott King in 1985. His other books include In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s, and Malcolm X, The FBI File. Let's start with an excerpt of King's acceptance speech upon receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964.
I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up. I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, and nonviolent redemptive goodwill proclaim the rule of the land, and the lion and the lamb shall lie down together, and every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. I still believe that we shall overcome.
Martin Luther King recorded December 10, 1964. That speech is collected in the book The Call to Conscience, the landmark speeches of Martin Luther King, one of the 4 volumes of King's work edited by Claiborne Carson. I asked Carson to reflect on something Dr. King had said or written that seems particularly relevant today.
Well, I think during the past year, obviously, the big issue has been war and peace and the war in Iraq. And early in that year, I began pulling together King's statements on war and peace. And during the course of the year, we had a couple of readings in which actors Aldo Billingsley and Danny Glover read a script that I had written with King's statements about war and peace. And of course, I chose the ones that I felt would be most relevant to the issues today. But it surprised me how much the audiences responded to King's words and very quickly began to think of them not so much as coming from King through an actor, but as speaking to them about with a great deal of wisdom and foresight about how they should think about the war. So that was quite striking. And one of the things that I hadn't expected as I was going through the lecture he gave when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, is that he actually uses the phrase weapons of mass destruction in terms of warning the world, the nations of the world, against having weapons of mass destruction.
Would you like to play for us an excerpt of one of the King's speeches that you used in this presentation that you were just mentioning with the 2 actors?
Well, I think the lecture itself is something that doesn't get played as much. King's acceptance of the Nobel Prize was a much shorter speech. But the lecture was a quite long address. It was about an hour long. And in it, he talked about the need to deal with the evils of the world. And one of them, of course, is violence, which you would expect. But then he goes on to poverty, and finally he ends with war. And he says, recent events have vividly reminded us that nations are not reducing, but rather increasing their arsenals of weapons of mass destruction. And he goes on to warn against the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and to warn also that while worrying about a world war, which would involve nuclear weapons, we should also worry about limited wars, which he feels also threaten the future of the world.
So let's hear a short excerpt of the speech that Martin Luther King gave in December of 1964 upon receiving his Nobel Peace Prize.
So we must fix our visions not merely on the negative expulsion of war, but upon the positive affirmation of peace. We must see that peace represents a sweeter music, a cosmic melody that is far superior to the discords of war. Somehow we must transform the dynamics of the world power struggle from the negative nuclear arms race, which no one can win, to a positive contest to harness man's creative genius for the purpose of making peace and prosperity a reality for all of the nations of the world. In short, we must shift the arms race into a peace race if we have the will and determination to mount such a peace offensive. We will unlock hitherto tightly sealed doors of hope and transform our imminent cosmic elegy into a psalm of creative fulfillment. All that I have said boils down to the point of affirming that mankind's survival is dependent upon man's ability to solve the problems of racial injustice, poverty, and war. The solution of these problems is in turn dependent upon man squaring his moral progress with his scientific progress and learning the practical art of living in harmony. Some years ago, a novelist died. Among his papers was a list of suggested story plots for further stories, the most prominently underscored being this one: a widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. This is a great new problem of mankind. We have inherited a big house, a great world house, in which we have to live together, black men and white men, Easterners and Westerners, Gentiles and Jews, Catholics and Protestants, Muslims and Hindus, a family unduly separated in ideas, culture, and interests, who, because we can never again live without each other, must learn somehow in this one big world house to live with each other. And this is our great challenge.
That was Martin Luther King, recorded in 1964 after receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. My guest, Claiborne Carson, directs the Martin Luther King Papers Project. You know, it's funny, you chose to play for us something that showed Martin Luther King's anti-war position. And in a way, historically, I think that's been his most controversial position. I think it would be difficult in America now to find somebody who supported segregation. And even if they did support it, they would probably, unless they're quite an extremist, they would probably be reluctant to admit it. Whereas I think a lot of people would say that that pacifism, it like doesn't work, that Martin Luther King, you know, was naive, that wars always happen, they always will happen.
Well, I think that that's one of the aspects of King that I find most troubling is the way in which the relevance of his ideas are narrowed down to the field of civil rights, when from the beginning he's really talking about a broader range of issues having to do with social justice and how to resolve issues of conflict in the world. And I think that King, when you see him, even in the 1950s, you know, it's long before the Vietnam War. He's speaking out very clearly on issues of international peace, calling for disarmament on a world scale. And one of the things that came through our research for Volume 5 of the Papers of Martin Luther King, which will be out later this year, is his trip to India in 1959. And during that time, as you know, India was moving away from the Gandhian legacy. And King came as a convinced Gandhian to India. And what you see in the statements and the speeches that he gave in India is his effort to try to deal with a country that is torn between kind of Gandhian ideals and the reality of building a modern nation that can, you know, compete and perhaps even go to war with Pakistan. Even then, issues like Kashmir were on the scene. And when he leaves India, one of the things I found very striking was that he called upon India to lead the world, to lead the United States and the Soviet Union to eliminate fear by disarming themselves. And he said, unfortunately, America and the Soviet Union have not shown the faith and moral courage to do this, but perhaps India might. And he makes this call for India to declare itself for disarmament unilaterally. Now, looking back, you can see that as quite naive in the sense that India probably under Nehru by that time has clearly made the decision that they're not going to go down the Gandhian path. You know, so for King, as an American Gandhian coming there, he's almost more Gandhian than the Indians themselves. And it's a striking statement, and it's one that shows the consistency of King's ideas and his struggle to apply them to the world as he found it.
My guest is Claiborne Carson, director of the King Papers Project. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Claiborne Carson. He directs the King Papers Project, which is collecting and publishing Martin Luther King's writings and speeches. How old were you when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
I was 24 at that time, and just returned from Europe. I was actually a draft dodger, and I had left the United States in 1967 and came back right before King's assassination in 1968. And you can imagine the changes that went on in the United States during 67 and 68. So I really came back to a different country than the one I left.
What are your memories of the day he was assassinated, and what went through your mind that day? What did you do that day?
Well, it was kind of the thought of, welcome back to the United States. This is what you left behind, and this is what you've returned to. You know, it was not only King's assassination, but all the violence that happened immediately afterwards. It was a way of kind of readjusting myself to the realities of this nation. I had had a sense when I was gone that although I had felt torn between wanting to leave the United States and also wanting to stay and see how the struggle was going to work itself out. And I think that coming back, I had a sense of the loss, you know, that King's voice was no longer going to be there. At the time, I was probably more critical of King than I am now. You know, I was probably more drawn to the Black Panther Party and the voices of Black Power at that time, but it hit me probably like it hit everyone, even people who are critical of King, how important it was to have his voice and to have him on the scene arguing for his point of view. And I think in the years since then, he's grown, well, I've grown wiser as I've gotten older, because I've begun to recognize the wisdom of many of his ideas.
Why, as a young man, were you a little dismissive of Martin Luther King and more drawn to the Black Power movement?
I think some of it just had to do with youth. I mean, I like a lot of people who went through the struggles of the 1960s, there was a period, I think, probably by 64 and 65, when many of us just didn't want to engage in nonviolent protest anymore. There was a sense of why should we be, kind of held to the standard of nonviolence, especially at the time when we were getting our draft notices to go off to fight in the war in Vietnam. It just didn't make any sense anymore. And I think that for King to have that consistent advocacy of nonviolence, it became easy to just dismiss him and just say, well, it's not going to get resolved that way. It'll get resolved through violence. And I think what perhaps many of us didn't recognize is that a lot of that violence would be inwardly directed. There were probably more Black people killed through the internal struggles of the movement in the late 1960s than the external struggles in some cases. And I think that...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, there was a lot of ideological conflict within the Black struggle. And... for example, I was on the UCLA campus when there was the killing of two Black Panthers by members of the US organization. And to be in a situation where Black people were killing other Black people because they didn't agree with the ideas, it gives a new relevance to King's call for nonviolence. It's not just a matter of violence and the struggle for civil rights and Black freedom. It's a matter of what kind of a world are you trying to bring about. And, when King says, an eye for an eye eventually leaves everyone blind, that applies to Black-on-Black violence, too. And I think that once we went down that road, I think we began to have second thoughts about... this notion of armed rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you come back to King and see what he was doing at the end of his life and understand, as we began to understand in the 70s and 80s, that the economic issues were the unaddressed problems of the 1960s, that we didn't really deal with the legacy of decades of injustice. And that's where we are still today. I mean, in some ways, King's question in 1967, where do we go from here, is still the question. Once we have achieved civil rights reform, what do we do next? How do we really bring about some kind of social justice in the world when you have this huge division, this huge gulf between the rich and the poor? And, I think those of us who kind of went toward the Black Power direction, we really didn't develop answers for that, at least answers that were going to work. King didn't resolve it either, but at least he was very consistent that that was the problem. That was the problem that needed to be addressed.
I'd like you to play for us an excerpt of a speech you'd like us to hear and to think about on this 75th anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King. So perhaps you can choose a short excerpt of a speech for us and tell us why this is the one.
Yes, this selection that I've thought about comes from the next volume of the King Papers, Volume 5, which is being done under the editorship of Tanisha Armstrong. And in this, King is responding to having been arrested during the Atlanta sit-ins in 1960. And this event plays a role in the presidential election because Kennedy intervenes on King's behalf to try to get him out of jail, and Nixon does not, and that helps decide the election because the Black vote goes very heavily to Kennedy. And this interviewer is asking King, after getting out of jail, does he really have a desire to be a martyr? And I think King's response is one that tells a lot about what he wanted to accomplish with his life, his view of his own role, and certainly about the mission of the movement as he saw it.
Well, before we hear an excerpt of that 1960 interview, Claiborne Carson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Was this your intent when this series of events started in the sit-in? Do you feel that you should become the image of the martyr in this country?
Well, I would hasten to say that I have no desire to be a martyr. I don't have a martyr complex. I don't enjoy suffering. And I don't have any desire to die. I'd like to live as long as anybody. My only concern is that we solve this problem of racial injustice, which to my mind is one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult problems facing our nation today. It is certainly America's greatest moral dilemma. And my involvement in the struggle is not merely for Martin Luther King. It isn't merely for the Negro. It is to save the soul of America, and because I think the whole struggle is morally right. Now, being involved in it will inevitably bring some suffering, and I will try to take that with all of the strength and all of the power of endurance that God will give me in the process, as I constantly pray. The prayer is, give me the power of endurance. But the basic aim, and certainly my basic concern, is that the problem will be solved, and that it will be solved in a moral way. Therefore, it is as important for me to have moral means as it is to achieve a moral end.
Martin Luther King speaking with Zena Sears on WAOK in Atlanta in 1960. Claiborne Carson directs the King Papers Project at Stanford University, which is collecting, editing, and publishing the writings and speeches of Martin Luther King. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Five Men Who Broke My Heart, a memoir by Susan Shapiro, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Shirley Barnhart shares her memories of Martin Luther King. She's a lifelong member of the Ebenezer Baptist Church, where King served as co-pastor with his father. Now Barnhart shares the history of the church with its visitors. And we listen back to an interview with the late civil rights activist James Farmer about being jailed in Mississippi. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The church was at the center of Martin Luther King's life and of the civil rights movement. King was the co-pastor with his father at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. The building that he preached in, now known as the Heritage Sanctuary, is undergoing renovations. The Ebenezer Baptist Church opened a new, larger building in 1999 called the Horizon Sanctuary. If you visit the older sanctuary, you may hear the history of the church told by its staff member, Shirley Barnhart. She's a lifelong member of Ebenezer Baptist Church and knew Martin Luther King when she was growing up. Her family had followed King's grandfather when he moved from rural Greensboro, Georgia, to Atlanta to preach at Ebenezer. King was 9 years older than Barnhart. She says she always knew he was special.
When I was like 5, 6 years old, I tell this story all the time. He was a teenager then, and he used to be here at the church with us whenever we were all here for whatever. It could be through the week, it could be on Sundays for whatever. And he would see us as children, like 5, 6 years old. And that's the first time I remember knowing him, because he used to pick me up along with the other little children here, throw us up in the air, catch us and put us down and hug on us. Every time, and we didn't call him Dr. King because he wasn't Dr. King at that time, and I still don't call him that unless I'm talking to people that didn't know him. His name was M.L., standing for Martin Luther. Now, he would do it every time and seem as though when I would see him coming toward us, I would try to hide because a lot of times he didn't know that I would be dizzy when he put me down. And when I was like that age growing on up, it was something about him then, and I did not know what it was. I could not be myself around him. I was so painfully shy of him. Because he had this presence. Now, I couldn't have told you this years, when I was that young. But as I grew older and older, I knew something was very, very special about him. And then one time I had to sing a solo here in 63. And Coretta heard about it. She called me up. She said, "Shirley, what you going to sing?" And I told her about this soprano, Lynn Thin Price, I had heard on the Ed Sullivan Show one Sunday evening, and I said, "I would like to sing A City Called Heaven. I heard this opera singing it." So she said, "Okay, get the music and bring it up to the house," because we lived a couple of blocks from them at that time over here, and they call it now the historical area. But back in those days, it was just the neighborhood where you lived. Okay, I took the music up and never dreaming he was going to come home that morning from wherever he had been. And I was singing, rehearsing with Coretta, and all of a sudden he came in and he saw me. He had on this overcoat and hat I never will forget. And he looked at me, he says, "Oh, we're going to have this great boy singing for us Sunday morning." Now, it went in one ear and out the other at that time. I didn't even think about what he had said. But, years and years later, I thought about it, and I have it on a recording because I had a concert here in 96. And I told that story about how that happened. I said, "Now, how many people can say Dr. King called their voice great?" So I can.
So initially, you knew Martin Luther King as like a big brother.
Oh, yes, yes.
But when he started preaching, mm-hmm. are there things that he said early on that really stuck in your mind?
I never will forget the sermon he preached. I was pregnant with my youngest child. I was sitting up in the balcony, and that was the year of 67, sort of toward the end of that year, probably in October of 67, because she was born in December. He was saying that Sunday, "When that day comes," and these were his words, "when that day comes, don't talk about all of my awards. Don't talk about my Nobel Peace Prize. Don't talk about where I went to school. But say on that day, I tried to feed the hungry. I tried to clothe the naked. I tried to help somebody. And that's what he was all about. And that sermon, those words have stayed with me all of these years.
How did he affect your thinking about the civil rights movement? Were you ever an activist?
No. You know what? I get this question a lot. We weren't involved as members in a lot of that because Reverend King Sr. never encouraged us as members to get involved with all of that. First of all, he was afraid for his son. That was number one. And he didn't want him to do that. Now, this is public knowledge. Reverend King was so afraid that something was going to happen to him, and which it did years and years later. So whenever ML was away marching in jail and all that, we just waited for him to come back home. I never thought about getting out there, because, see, the marches weren't here in Atlanta. They were in Mississippi and Alabama and other places. We never had bad race relations here, so we didn't have any marches.
So did you not really strongly identify with the movement at the time?
No, because I was young, raising, having my children, and I just never thought about it, really.
Did you ever go to him for advice?
No, never did. I never did. When I was up to the house before he married Coretta, we would just, would be there with him. And I say this sometimes, and all of that time, I never saw him casual dressed. He was always with a suit and towel. I was just so shy of him. We all had crushes on him anyway, all the teenagers.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I was one of the main ones. I used to write him little notes, and when church was over, I would try to figure out how I was going to send him this note, give it to him. And one of the little girls was with me. She would say, "Shirley, when you shake his hand, just leave it in his hand."
Did you do that?
Yeah. And to this day, I don't know what I wrote on that note, on those notes, rather.
Did your children spend as much time in church as you did as a child?
Oh, not as much, because when they were coming along, they had more things to do than we did. But they were here from the moment they came into the world up until they came out of high school. So the second son that was dedicated by Dr. King at 3 months, he truly, truly loves his church, just about like me, because he is so much like me that, and now he's with the Count Basie's Orchestra.
Oh, what does he play?
He plays the trumpet.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, and he's, when Dr. King held him up that Sunday morning, we didn't know he was going to be here to dedicate him. I thought Reverend King Sr. would do it, because he always would do it if ML wasn't here. But he was here that Sunday, and he held Scotty up. He said, "Scotty, you're going to be somebody great one day." And of all the things that he said to Scotty and my family, because we were right on the pulpit with him and Scotty, that particular statement never left me. I didn't dwell on it in the beginning, but years and years later, I thought about it, and I will say I believe that's why Scotty is where he is today, because if he were living, he would try to go to every one of their concerts. That's how he was about us, anybody here at this church.
My guest is Shirley Barnhart, a lifelong member of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where Martin Luther King was co-pastor with his father. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Shirley Barnhart is on the staff of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where Martin Luther King was co-pastor with his father. Barnhart is a lifelong member of the church and knew King when she was growing up. How did you find out that Martin Luther King was assassinated?
I never will forget it. I was home looking at the news at 7 o'clock. It came on the 7 o'clock news. I will never, when I heard it, I went almost crazy. We all was screaming and hollering. I got in my car, and my mother, if she were living, she could tell you, I gathered up as many church members as I could. I called them, and I went by and picked my mother up and a few other church members. And you talking about raining, I have never, ever seen it rain like that since in my life. I couldn't hardly see going out of the expressway to get to the parents' home. That's where we were headed, to the, not to his house, but to the parents' home. And when we got there, I never will forget seeing Richard Nixon, Sammy Davis Jr., a lot of the celebrities had come in that night. And it was on, now Coretta was at her house. And but I wanted to be with the parents because they were like my parents. And I never will forget when I was getting ready to leave to come home, I went upstairs to Reverend King Sr.'s bedroom to let him know we were leaving. And when I peeped in the door and opened the door a little bit, there stood Dr. Mays, who was the president of Morehouse College. He was a very close friend of Reverend King Sr., and other ministers were standing there. And I said, Reverend King, we're getting ready to leave. And you know what he said to me?
What did he say?
Shirley, do you have a way home?
See,
he was always concerned about his members having a way home at night from church. Isn't that something?
Martin Luther King seemed to have a premonition that he might be killed.
Yeah, he did.
Was that something that you, as a close friend of the family, had been aware of?
Not me per se, but I knew it sort of toward the end of his life, because of the things he was saying. You know, like the sermon he preached about. You know,
the one you mentioned when we earlier when we were talking.
And then,
yeah.
When he was down in Memphis for the march down there. But let me say this, right before he left, going to Memphis, he knew my baby girl was going to be dedicated by him. And he told Coretta to tell me that he couldn't wait to see her because when she was born, he was, you know, in and out, real busy. So he hadn't had a chance to see her, but he knew he was going to dedicate her that first Sunday in April. And he said, tell Shirley, I can't wait to see the baby, and, you know, I'll be back from Memphis. So he just knew he was coming back, but he didn't get back. So Reverend King Sr. had to dedicate her. So that's how I know how long he's been dead from her age. She just turned 36 in December. So I have a card, a baby card that he and Coretta sent me when she was born. I still have that. I don't have the envelope. I don't know where that is, but I have the card.
Now, there's a new Ebenezer Baptist Church that was built with, like, 2,000 seats. It's much bigger and more modern than the original church.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that's where, is that where all the services are held now?
Yes,
or just,
that's where we worship now. We don't worship over here anymore.
So you're speaking to us from the old church. Can you still pray in the old church, even though the services aren't there?
Yeah, I go up every day to pray and meditate when I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I start my day. And I can't describe how I feel when I walk in there. I just feel God's presence. That church is really anointed. And I feel like one day, I may not be here to see it, but God gonna have somebody there to preach on Sundays, to have a choir back in that choir stand, to worship, because that church was not built to be closed by anybody, for anybody. Dr. King would turn over in his grave if he knew that church was closed. His father, his grandfather, the first pastor. But I can't do anything about it other than pray and hope that one day God will let us worship back in there, because that's what it was built for.
Well, Shirley Barnhart, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Shirley Barnhart is a lifelong member of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta and is now on the staff. She mentioned that her son Scotty Barnhart plays trumpet in the Count Basie Band. Here he is with the band from the album Count Plays Duke. The Basie Orchestra is conducted by Grover Mitchell. Coming up, what it was like to be in a Mississippi jail in 1961. We listen back to an interview with the late civil rights activist James Farmer. This is Fresh Air. Like Martin Luther King, James Farmer applied Gandhi's principles of nonviolent resistance to the civil rights movement. Farmer co-founded CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. The group's nonviolent demonstrations were answered with attacks by white mobs and mass arrests of CORE members during the Freedom Rides in the early 60s. CORE's interracial groups of freedom riders rode buses through the southern states to see to it that the Supreme Court's decision banning segregation in bus terminals was actually being enforced. The resulting drama focused national attention on the violence of southern racism. Farmer died in 1999 at the age of 79. We're going to hear an excerpt of the interview I recorded with him in 1985. He told me that he wasn't with the Freedom Riders when they went into Alabama because he went home to Washington, D.C. to be at his father's funeral. The young white Freedom Rider in charge of the Birmingham Rides was nearly killed. Farmer rejoined the Freedom Riders just as the buses were about to head into Mississippi.
Mississippi at that time had the reputation of being the ultra, the apex of racism. And I thought that what had happened in Alabama then would be only a prelude to what awaited us in Mississippi. Yet the young Freedom Riders, SNCC young people, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, from Nashville, young CORE people from New Orleans had joined forces in Montgomery to take the ride into Jackson. And I was there, and they presumed I was going with them since it was my show. Nobody asked me if I was going. They just assumed it. But I had other thoughts. Because, my father had just died. And two deaths in the family in a week would be a bit much for my mother and for the family. Furthermore, I'd been away from my office for 6 weeks, and mail had piled high, and people needed answers to their letters, and Corps had to raise money to keep its activities going, including the Freedom Ride, and I was needed to help in that process. Oh, I'd cataloged all of these excuses in my mind, but the bottom line was that I was scared to death, and that's the reason I didn't want to go. And I was determined not to go because I wanted to live. I did not want to die then. I went down that morning that the young Freedom Riders were going to board their buses for the journey from Montgomery, Alabama, to Jackson, Mississippi. I went down really to say goodbye to them and wish them Godspeed. I remember reaching through the open window of a bus to shake hands with 17-year-old Corps girl from New Orleans, Doris Castle. I said, "Well, Doris, have a safe journey. And after the Freedom Rides, we'll get together and we'll discuss the next step." She looked at me in disbelief. She said, "But, Jim, you're going with us, aren't you?" And I said, "Oh, well, no, Doris, you see." And then I went through the whole litany of excuses which I had prearranged in my mind. She shook her head and said, "Jim, please." Well, that was too much. I had to go then.
Well, you encountered quite a lot of trouble on that ride. You were all arrested. What grounds were you arrested on?
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And other Freedom Riders followed the two of us, and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my Corps staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting Freedom Riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out?
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away, and then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come, and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place, and that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference, so that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, these words. I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. Said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Freedom Ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County, where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, no neutrals have they met. You're either for the Freedom Ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett. He was the governor of Mississippi. My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. And I'll stick to the Freedom Ride till every battle's won. Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other Freedom Riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
James Farmer recorded in 1985. He died 14 years later at the age of 79. We'll close with the SNCC Freedom Singers, recorded in Atlanta in the spring of 1964. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Auster talks about his new novel, Oracle Night. The last time he was on Fresh Air, we ran out of time just as he started to tell the story of the car accident he'd recently been in with his family. Oracle Night is in part about the fragility of life, so we'll pick up where we left off. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.